don't frighten us by telling us the facts. 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 We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on January 21st, 2018, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me to talk about how we think and talk about World War I a century later. Then, Rachel joins me to talk about the evils of federal program work requirements. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio this week for our first segment is Nate. Welcome back to the program.
Great to be here, Bill.
So we're going to be talking about, in this segment, about World War I and sort of some of the modern conceptions of that war as we are moving into the final year of the centennial sort of commemorations of that war. I think that especially in the United States, to a much greater extent than some of the other countries that participated, because the United States was only in it for like a year and a half or a little bit more than that, it has been completely overshadowed by World War II, and the U.S. role in the war was relatively limited. So in many respects, it was kind of like overlooked and forgotten after a while. But in many countries, it's this huge monumental thing that really transformed their countries in many, many ways, positive or negative. Several countries collapsed as a result of the war. A lot of big changes happened at the end. I think that last year in 2017, because that was the 100th anniversary of things like the Russian Revolution, there was a lot of discussion about a lot of those revolutions and the aftermath of those in various countries. I think that was sort of the big focus for 2017. Back in 2014, there was some interesting things that happened. Like, I mean, interesting is one way of putting it. But for example, I wrote an article about how the Alps ice in the Italian-Austrian theater was melting, and all these bodies that had been in these like ice trenches were suddenly coming to the surface from the snow and the ice. And basically, like, I was comparing sort of the struggle with global warming to like World War I, where there was kind of this like, oh no, what if we get into a war? Oops, we're in a war and we have to go through with it. You know, there was a lot of this sort of like self-perpetuating logic that didn't really make any sense, and the war wasn't inevitable. And so I was talking a lot about that. But the thing in Italy kind of highlighted an example of like, hey, this war went way beyond the Western Front, which is what a lot of the focus has been on, because, well, that's where the British were, that's where the French were, and that's where the Americans ended up. But there were theaters of war all over the world, in colonial territories. There was some major action in Turkey, as a lot of people are aware. There was stuff happening on the Eastern Front with the Russians, that sort of thing. So there was a lot of stuff going on. Many interesting stories, especially surrounding the collapse of these various states. Some, you know, odd things started happening. There's like the sort of great story of the Czechoslovak legions trying to flee across Siberia on a stolen armored train to evacuate through Vladivostok, and, you know, being pursued by the Bolsheviks. So there's been a lot of these like kind of, I guess, new old stories over the past several years as people try to figure out like how do we tell the story of World War One? What's the important parts to know? I know in France, there's a lot more emphasis now about the 1917 mutinies, where a lot of French troops were just completely fed up and tried to basically leave the war and sometimes killed their officers, that sort of thing. But Nate wanted to talk about sort of some of the various angles of how we're now sort of reconceptualizing the war, bringing that kind of to new audiences. And there's a whole bunch of different things. We'll post a whole bunch of articles as well on arsenalfordemocracy.com, so you can read up on some of the things that we're not going to be able to like get that into depth on. Before we get into some of the really detailed historiography stuff, I guess let's talk about a video game that has kind of really put this war front and center for a lot of new audiences lately. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so the most recent installment of the Battlefield franchise, going back maybe about a decade or so, is set in World War One, so called BF1, obviously. And yeah, the game came out, I think, late 2015, and has sort of, it's been pretty successful, I would say, and they've released numerous expansions, and they just released some of the info for the last expansion. So we sort of now see the full extent of the game. And, you know, I've played a fair amount of it, probably more than a fair amount, and it's definitely fun. Maybe it's not a perfect game in many respects, you can critique it, but I think it is interesting in the way that it sort of shows the full extent of the war and how you know, sort of takes it out of the trenches of the Western Front and moves it around all across Europe and including the Middle East. So there are maps, you know, in the Suez, in Sinai, sort of in Iraq. There are all sorts of, there's a large expansion focused on the Russian Civil War and a lot of the battles on the Eastern Front. So between, say, like the Russians and the Austro-Hungarians and like Galicia, and all sorts of stuff that you don't normally think about when you think about the First World War. Also, parts of the First World War you don't really think about, even on the Western Front. So stuff like the Nivelle Offensive, they have maps about that, sort of a nighttime raid type of maps. They're also introducing soon, I think in the next couple of weeks, large-scale naval maps. So there's no Battle of Jutland, but there's stuff based on the Battle of Heligoland Bight and the Zeebrugge Raid. They've also recently introduced the whole Gallipoli landing and all the things around there. That's, you know, famous movie, things like that. So there's all sorts of different, I think, interesting examples of different parts of the war that we don't normally think about, including, you know, adding in all the different vehicles and stuff that sort of were pioneered in this war. So all the different types of tanks, but you still have horses running around. Like, you have a horse trying to take on a tank, which is quite fun. You've got your giant zeppelins that float above the battle. So there's going to be dreadnought combat coming pretty soon. And flying around wooden biplanes and triplanes is quite fun as well as all the interesting special weapons like, you know, gas and flamethrowers and all sorts of crazy stuff like that. So I think it does do a decently interesting job of sort of portraying the sort of scope and variety of different types of experiences during the war.
One of the things that I think has come up a lot in sort of trying to reconceptualize the war for present day audiences is talking more about the colonial experience, whether the fighting was actually in the colonies or these were people who were, you know, voluntarily or in many cases kind of coerced to go and serve in the European theaters of combat. And some of the articles, you know, that you looked up, there was a couple Guardian articles, one from 2008, one from 2017. There was an article as well from isj.org.uk, which is an international socialist publication, talking about some of these colonial experiences, the transformative effect that had on many of these countries, kind of bringing a lot of their racism to the fore by putting them around people from Africa or India or wherever, and kind of enforcing various presences like that. And then, of course, there's sort of the ongoing thing, similar to the experience that many of the trade unions within Europe had, which was that there was this debate within, say, independence movements at the time of like, well, do we support the war effort of this empire that we're trying to leave, whether it's the French Empire or the British Empire or the German Empire or what have you, or do we try to use this as our opportunity to, you know, escape their colonial grasp? In many cases, just like with the socialists and unionists in Europe itself, a lot of the independence movement people decided, kind of perhaps surprisingly, that they would go along with the war effort or at least not stand in the way, I guess because they didn't want to have the fate of many of the American socialists and trade unionists, which was getting imprisoned for speaking out against the war, you know, as traitors or whatever, and that could have potentially cut off the independence movements really early. But I guess talk to me a little bit more about this sort of colonial angle. I saw one of the articles mention, because you were just talking about things like the gas and the machine guns and everything. One of these articles had some comment about that, like the sort of brutality that had been imposed upon these colonial peoples who couldn't fight back during the colonization process of the late 19th century. This was now being turned on many of the European troops.
Yeah, this article in The Guardian entitled How Colonial Violence Came Home, The Ugly Truth of the First World War, I think does a good job of sort of going in depth and mentioning, as you mentioned, people like Mahatma Gandhi, W.E. Du Bois were supportive of the war. You know, in they sort of had their sort of formulations as to why this would benefit colonized people and things like that. But it does sort of go in depth, sort of showing that sort of undermining the sort of traditional historiography, talking about, oh, they sort of sleptwalked into war. There was this long peace, and this is sort of burst that bubble, pointing out it's like actually this was a extremely racist, white supremacist society, that all the, you know, eugenicist ideas and, you know, people believed in all sorts of weird racial hierarchies and things like that were very much in vogue there. So it created all sorts of interesting conflicts and panics and scandals. For example, the Daily Mail printed a photograph of a British nurse treated a wounded Indian soldier, and then they had to withdraw white nurses from hospitals treating Indians, and all sorts of things like that. And this article actually points out that the Daily Mail basically hasn't changed since back then. They're still promoting the same types of lines about immigrants. So that, I thought that was interesting. And just sort of, it goes through and just describes how a lot of this colonial violence, including things that we've mentioned here on the show, such as the genocide of the Hiro and Nama peoples by the German Empire in Africa, that was a pretty serious, this sort of, some of these formulations came back home, the Boer War, as we've talked about, and a lot of this, and sort of, it also makes the point that the Germans, you know, relatively compared to, say, the British and French, it wasn't quite the sort of liberal democracy versus despotism that is sort of framed even today.
Well, I think that's been sort of a huge theme. And one of the reasons that Wonder Woman movie from 2017 was sort of a baffling throwback amid this sort of renewed historiography is that the way that movie was cast was like the propaganda poster style. We've got to defeat the evil Huns and the Krauts and whatever, you know, and saying that Germany started the war. It was their fault. And, you know, that we had to enter this war because they were evil, menacing expansionists. I think a lot of the sort of World War II narratives got really stacked on top of that. In a way that, I mean, obviously at the end of the war, they did put a lot of effort into trying to blame Germany officially in the Treaty of Versailles and things like that. But like beyond that, things like just saying, oh, you know, they violated Belgian neutrality, so therefore we had to invade or whatever, like that's sort of getting a little bit carried away, because fundamentally, for the most part, if not all of these combatants were basically just rival empires that got mad at each other and made some mistakes going into it. But like it's ambiguous. Like toward the end of the war, some people have said, and this is part of the revising the history, that kind of thing, some people have argued, I think credibly, that like there were many members of the German high command that were like interested in pursuing what would later become sort of Nazi purification ideas that were sort of like the proto versions of that.
Oh, yeah.
That they were just going to do genocide if they won the war or whatever. But like that was never, those people were never really in a position to actually do that. But like at the beginning of the war, which is sort of what matters more in this respect, like the notion that there were good empires versus evil empires is just kind of bizarre. And like the Germans were just another sort of party to this war, right?
Right. And, you know, as we've mentioned, they've had their own colonial atrocities, things like that, and we shouldn't underplay those. But when you compare the size of their empire to, say, the British and the French, it's sort of, you know, it sort of speaks to that. But I do want to return a little bit to speaking about the colonial troops and just going from this article, the experience of mass death and destruction suffered by most Europeans only after 1914 was widely known in Asia and Africa, where both land and resources were forcibly usurped, economic and cultural infrastructure systematically destroyed, and entire populations eliminated with the help of up-to-date bureaucracies and technologies. Europe's equilibrium was parasitic far too long on disequilibrium elsewhere. In the end, Asia and Africa could not remain a safe remote venue for Europe's wars of aggrandizement in the late 19th and 20th century. And if you think about it, you know, you sort of have this image of these colonial forces with their Maxim guns, you know, mowing down the native peoples there. And that sort of is then translated onto the, you know, into no man's land and the various fronts where people are just killing each other with machine guns like they would, you know, the people of their colonies. So I also want to get back to in the specific game. It is notable that sort of the headliner of this game, like the image that you often see associated with it, is a member of the Harlem Hellfighters, who are an American, about 400,000 American, African-American soldiers were sent over, and they actually ended up fighting alongside the French because they wouldn't be part of the U.S. Army, still segregated at the time. So that's sort of the main figure associated with the cover of the game there. And also, as the Russian expansion came out, they also introduced a woman who was a member of the Women's Death Battalions in Russia. A lot of these were formed, I think, after the February Revolution and meant to sort of like inspire morale on the front. Didn't really work all that well. Yeah,
yeah, the Russian army was pretty well into its collapse at that point, but there were still people who were trying to say, hey, we have to hold the line and prevent the Germans from taking all this territory, you know, on the Eastern Front, which was Russia's Western Front, actually. But basically, the Poland, Ukraine, Baltic areas, those sort of things, they were trying to prevent those from falling into German hands.
Right. And it is notable that women fought in the war, and specifically in those death battalions. So that is interesting. I'm actually watching a documentary right now about the role of women in World War One. And so in addition, you also have for the British, some of their medics are Indian, depending on the map. So obviously speaking to the, I think it was about 1.5 million British Indian troops were involved in the war in some way. Also, in the Gallipoli maps, the medics are Anzac, so they have the sort of like cowboy hat off to one side. And also notable is the presence of black German soldiers who were not actually prominent on the Western Front or even in Europe, but they were. There's no maps for Africa in this, but there was a large corps of the Schutztruppe Askari, I think it's called, under Paul von Leto Lorbeck, which were they're fighting the British in Africa. So that could have been interesting to portray, but they didn't end up doing that, which is too bad. Also notable, this game sort of caused this was sort of after the peak of Gamergate in 2014, things like that. But a lot of people were complaining about the presence of non-white soldiers, basically. And it is interesting, this article notes that Hitler himself thought that black soldiers was a Jewish plot. And this sort of, you know, goes back to the whole cultural Marxism, Judeo-Bolshevism, that everyone thinks, video game, non-white video game characters are basically Jewish plots. So, I mean, that's what these people think. So you also have, I thought it was interesting, talking about in the International Socialist article, often talks about how the colonial troops had white officers, and you could basically not advance farther than, I think, the sergeant rank. So they could, I guess, become decorated at least a little bit, but they could never, you know, command over others, definitely not command over white troops, obviously not. So it was also interesting talking about how a lot of these colonies were basically, squeezed to support the war effort. So higher taxes, a lot of the resources would go to supporting the war effort. So think like British colonies in the Caribbean or India, places like that, or French colonies in Africa. So in addition to their troops coming, they're also providing material for the war. Also talks about there was a large amount of Asian laborers who were hired, and a lot of the times they would be the ones who were doing the trench digging, or often like some menial type construction tasks or support tasks. And a lot of these times conditions were, you know, extremely poor, especially for the colonial laborers, but the rich officers often like lived much better than sort of the average soldier who were, you know, shivering in the trenches, but these guys were sort of like having tea and things like that. So is always better off to be upper class in British society, I would say. There's a decent amount of realism, I would say, to the game in terms of like if you're, you know, crawling on the ground, your weapons become all muddy and things like that. And it's also interesting sort of the perspective of being like a medic and trying to run around and like save people and heal people up. Oftentimes you'll heal someone and they'll just be blown up immediately by another shell. So it's sort of like, okay, what are we doing here? But it does sort of gives you a insight into that sort of futility of just trying to run around and save people that are obviously just going to be killed. There's a lot of different stuff going on that I think is really quite interesting. So
now, as I said at the beginning, you know, this is in 2018, this is the last year of the centennial phase of the war. And it's a lot different than something like, you know, if people are commemorating the fall of the Berlin Wall, that's like a discrete date that happened, as opposed to this sort of thing stretched over 4 years or so. Is there any sort of emerging consensus on like sort of the new way to think about the war, or are we still kind of like at various different fractured perspectives on it? You know, again, my sort of emphasis has been on the like socialists and trade unionists and the Russian Revolution and the other revolutions as well. And then to some extent, as I said, the issue of like framing the Germans as this evil empire entity that had to be defeated for moral reasons as opposed to just strategic defense against another empire. You know, there's always the propaganda posters that depicted the Germans as these, you know, guerrillas, yeah, and that were savaging the white women of Belgium or whatever, which of course is like employing racist anti-colonial, right, imagery against Germany,
yeah,
a fellow white empire.
POC, yeah.
Right.
You know, I think there's been some focus more recently on the Xmas truce, where, you know, you had Germans and French soldiers like playing soccer together on Christmas as sort of like a mini truce. There was a movie, Joyeuse Noël, that came out about that. I've also encountered stuff in the literature just about troops, say, singing the Internationale and like waving the red flag. And this caused officers and sort of higher ups to become very nervous because they were worrying about various revolts. And you mentioned that there are strikes and mutinies and things like that.
Right.
Often
there were French regiments demobilizing themselves. And there's a lot of speculation that if the U.S. had not entered the war around April and May of 1917, that France could have seen a Russian-style collapse where the government was basically overthrown and the military demobilized, or both of those things happened.
Yeah, and also I also want to point out the great work being done by the Great War YouTube channel. So it's been running from the beginning, 100 years after the beginning of the war, and we'll go up to the end, maybe beyond, possibly. But it does a pretty good job of doing videos about all sorts of different battles and stuff about the lifestyle of the soldiers and going in depth about some of the equipment and also going to various battlefields. So that's interesting. It's also important to point out the way that memorials still have a huge role. We talked a little bit about before the show about the Remembrance Day with all the poppies that exist in England. But also I can remember being in like a small French town in the Pyrenees and just seeing this massive World War I memorial. There were probably a couple dozen people at least in this very small town, but of that generation, a lot of them had been killed in the war. Probably they leave and then they never come back. So that's an interesting aspect of it. I guess going back, sort of the conclusion of this article talks about how the sort of global racial order that for centuries had bestowed power, identity, security, and status on its beneficiaries had begun to break down, and now it's sort of making a parallel with us as well. Not even war with China or ethnic cleansing in the West will restore to whiteness its ownership of the earth forever and ever. Regaining imperial power and glory has already proven to be a treacherous escapist fantasy. Devastating the Middle East and parts of Asia and Africa while bringing terrorism back to the streets of Europe and America, not to mention ushering Britain towards Brexit. No rousing quasi-imperialist adventures abroad can mask the chasm of class and education or divert the masses at home. Consequently, social problems appear insoluble. Acrimoniously polarized society seems to be on the verge of civil war that Rhodes had feared. And Brexit and Trump show the capacity for self-harm has grown ominously. And sort of goes in talking about the whiteness and quotes a little bit of James Baldwin there. But basically that it sort of makes the possibility that we could be sleepwalking towards something in the future. You never know. It also interesting to point this out. Sane thinking would require, at the very least, an examination of the history and stubborn persistence of racist imperialism, a reckoning that Germany alone among the Western powers has attempted. And that is interesting, because not so much talking about the First World War, but the Second World War, certainly. You know, I don't think Germany has certainly been perfect about this, and there's a lot of right-wing activism in Germany right now. But especially when you compare with, like, Britain, where polls show that a lot of British people still believe the empire was essentially benign. And I don't know too much about the French sort of polling on that, but I'm guessing that there's probably not been as much of an examination as would be required.
Well, something there that I've definitely talked about, and again, this definitely relates more to World War II than World War I, although there are elements for World War I as well, is that, like, if you're the defeated power, then they can impose upon you, like, mandatory reflection and making you feel bad and coming to terms with your empire or whatever. And after World War I, they did take away all the German colonies, so, like, there was elements of that as well. But, like, with World War I and World War II, France didn't lose its colonies. Britain didn't lose its colonies. Obviously, after World War II, you have a pretty rapid movement toward a lot of them becoming independent. But, like, the countries that, quote unquote, won the war, barely or whatever, in both cases, for most of those countries, they were not forced to, like, reckon with their own evils or anything like that in a way that they would have if they had lost. And certainly, like, there's so many things we could talk about. We didn't even have time to talk any at all about really the Middle East particularly. I mean, you mentioned it in passing a moment ago, but, like, there's a lot of stuff right now about the sort of collapse of the Ottoman Empire, that the centennials around that sort of internal coup d'etat process that leads to Turkey. There was a lot of stuff that happened after World War One that we basically never talk about, involving, like, France and Britain going to war with the new Turkish forces, as well as invading the British and Americans invading Russia. There's a lot of that kind of stuff, but not to get too off topic about it because we're out of time here. But, like, the Middle East in 2015, certainly, I think there were some centennial acknowledgments of, like, the Sykes-Picot and the various secret maps dividing up the Ottoman territories in the Middle East, and how that sort of fundamentally shapes a lot of present day Middle Eastern stuff.
I just wanted to point out a tweet from Trilburn saying society is probably going to recover from World War One any day now, which I thought was sort of apt for this, because, I mean, the effects are still ongoing.
Right. Even if we don't talk about it, the effects are still ongoing.
Even certainly, if you just look at borders, or, you know, especially in the Middle East.
Right.
As we're
but
about.
You know, even Turkey, like, they, you know, were kind of forcibly humiliated with the loss of all these Ottoman territories and stuff like that. They didn't take that very well. But, you know, there's always that distinction between the countries that were sort of the quote unquote winners and the quote unquote losers, and which ones were forced to, like, at an official level, deal with their sort of role, even when many of them were basically the same, and that wasn't, you know, particularly fairly distributed. Anyway, we are out of time for this segment, you know, there's so much more that can be covered. As I said earlier, arsenalfordemocracy.com will have in for the episode description and everything up there. You'll be able to access all these links. There's so many great articles, really in-depth, great reading material on there, so you can learn a lot more about this. But we did want to talk about it before we get too far into the sort of final centennial year. Nate, thank you so much for being here in studio this week.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
Arsenal for Democracy will be back in just a moment from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. Please stick around. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line now from Idaho is Rachel. Rachel, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on again, Bill.
We're going to be talking for the rest of this episode about work requirements. The Trump administration last year rolled back some very mild and not very heavily used Obama-era welfare work requirement waiver thingies, which were extremely mild. Not only did the states not really use them, but they were basically, because there wasn't any statutory authority, they just were like, we strongly encourage you to consider waiving your work requirements during this poorly going recovery from the recession. But that was sort of more of a symbolic thing. The big change that has happened now is that in 2018, as we're starting off the year in January 2018, the Trump administration has issued guidelines to the states at the request of several of these states to allow them to impose work requirements onto Medicaid, so opening a new frontier in work requirements. I saw a very unhelpful article saying, you know, there's bipartisan majorities in the public in favor of work requirements. This is very popular. Well, this is one of those cases where something that's popular among a lot of people, A, basically just reflects the elite consensus for the most part, because that's what people talk about at the elite level, but also, if it's popular and it's bad, well, it's still bad. So we're going to talk about why work requirements are bad today. Before we get into the details of the Medicaid work requirements, remember, Medicaid is basically the state-level provision of health insurance by the government with federal assistance for low-income people and certain other populations, often people with disabilities, or we've talked a lot about people who use Medicaid for nursing homes. We will be circling back to Medicaid to talk about those work requirements, but let's talk about the history of work requirements. This is something that was popularized as a concept by Richard Nixon, but not implemented for a while. The place that you really got to start on this topic is Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson's 1980s experiments with welfare to work in Wisconsin. This is known as the Wisconsin model, that then subsequently becomes the model for the 1996 federal workfare reforms, welfare reforms passed through a Republican Congress and enthusiastically supported by President Bill Clinton, one of his most awful policies. This Wisconsin model is pretty important to understand because it has actually spread to other countries. The Netherlands, for example, basically copied and pasted it to their system. So this is kind of an unusual topic because a lot of times we talk about like how other countries do something in a positive way to say like, hey, the US should do this too. This is one of those rare cases where a bunch of industrialized countries with nominally functioning social democracies decided to start imposing these bizarre neoliberal programs from the United States. And workfare is not necessarily the quintessential neoliberal program idea, but it is certainly up there in terms of, yeah, there's some bipartisan support for this wonky like thing where, you know, only the meritocratic deserving few get to qualify for these benefits. So the Tommy Thompson model and the 96 welfare reforms are obviously where we want to start there. The book that I recommend to people very strongly is Jason DeParle's book, American Dream, Three Women, 10 Kids, and a Nation's Drive to End Welfare. That's something that I think I read back in probably 2007 or so, almost a decade after welfare reform. He followed very closely in places like Milwaukee, Wisconsin, various welfare recipients sort of under the pre-model, you know, if they lived in another state first or whatever, and then how it was under Tommy Thompson, and then how things kind of deteriorate from there under the 1996 welfare reform. So Jason DeParle's book is very good if you want to know like kind of the real human cost that these work requirements imposed. And basically the core of the reform there is that the aid to families with dependent children, AFDC, which was known as welfare colloquially, that had been around for several decades, that was replaced by what we call TAMF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. And that included a two-year timeline to find work, so you could get benefits. You had to be looking for work, but if you didn't find work within 2 years, you were kicked off. And also, sort of shockingly, I think, imposed a lifetime limit of 5 years of federal assistance, so you couldn't go on and off of it periodically, etc. And if you were not able to find sufficient work or work that paid well enough, well, you were just out of luck after 5 years. Too bad for you. The other thing that comes in, which again is going to relate back to the Medicaid stuff because a lot of this is modeled on that, and Medicaid is also a sort of state block grant type of program, is that they use the state block grant model where the government, well, Rachel, you were saying before the show that like they give you a bunch of money, they let you experiment around with it, and then they don't really follow up on it, right?
Yeah, they kind of wash their hands of any responsibility to ask the states what they're doing with the money, how they're shuffling it around, what exactly is the tangible effects of giving states these block grants.
And in terms of the sort of impact of the work requirements, I read a citation to a book that was published after about 5 years of the welfare reform. From 1997, which was the first year of the new system, to 2000, more than half of the recipients either quit the program or were kicked off of it, presumably because the two-year window kicked in and they said, okay, you know, you didn't find work or whatever. basically not a great model, and there's a lot of research to show that this has been a pretty huge disaster, and yet it's still being used as this model for other things. I guess, Rachel, what should we focus on in terms of discussing the problems with TAMF, the welfare reform program?
Oftentimes, any gains in employment after these policies are put in place are ephemeral, inconsistent. Any success story is just kind of touted as a success, but any failure is probably due to other factors. So I think there's a lot of cherry picking of the effects of these programs being put into place to, quote unquote, reform the social safety net programs. But the data doesn't really fall out in favor of these. So I think the only success that TAMF has had is removing people from assistance roles, but the ensuing increase in child poverty, maternal poverty, really, really shows the lies for what they are, in that the reform has really done nothing but increase the misery and poverty in these vulnerable communities.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this stuff is just like adding more paperwork and more, you know, oh, go out and find a job. Doesn't matter if there's no jobs in your community. Doesn't matter if you have to commute 40 miles to a job or whatever. Just kind of issuing these edicts and just making life onerous and complicated. That's what a lot of these sort of requirements do. We've seen work requirements be literally added to food assistance, the SNAP program. So find a job or starve. I mean, it's hard to find a job if you're starving. So kind of really scrambling around things. Just not really understanding like how human beings work or like what an actual support program would look like. Let's talk about the maternal poverty issue a little bit though, and talk about this notion of like go find work and stop being lazy, which is sort of the like really explicitly stated framing of the welfare reform in the 1990s. We were talking before the show that a lot of the rhetoric around it would probably be a little bit less acceptable to openly say now in 2018 than it was at the time, but I guess we're about to find out with the Medicaid stuff. But let's talk about sort of the feminist angle against the welfare reforms of the 1990s, Rachel.
So the legislation was designed to increase labor market participation from women, but it really disregarded women who wanted to stay home to take care of their children. That suddenly they weren't allowed to anymore. They had to go out and find work. And so not only did they have to find a job, then they had to suddenly pay for childcare. So it was really like taking money out of one pocket to put money in the other. It didn't really make sense. It really devalued women's labor in the home, like not only for women taking care of children, but also women taking care of disabled relatives or parents or whatever. So it's kind of, I know second wave feminism was all about getting women out of the home, but at what cost, basically? So I think it is definitely a feminist issue because a lot of women are stuck in that middle generation where oftentimes they have to simultaneously take care of children as well as the older generation. So we need to start valuing that work in the home, kind of seeing that to put a price on it is meaningless because it is invaluable.
I guess to go in the opposite direction, though, to actually try to put a price on some of this. Interestingly, in 2005, when there was a debate over the funding, you know, it's time to set up the next round of funding for all these block grants and everything. Not only did they escalate the work requirements, poorly timed, they kicked in around 2007 when the next recession was about to start. But the Congressional Budget Office had estimated in order to make it possible for a lot of these women, many of whom are single mothers, in order for it to be possible for them to go get work, they have to obviously have some childcare in place. And if they don't have like an older relative or somebody who's able to, you know, a retired relative who's able to stay home with the kids or something, you're going to have to find childcare, that sort of thing. We've talked on the show before about how expensive that is. The Congressional Budget Office said it was going to take $12 billion in funding to provide the necessary level of childcare assistance for these women to be able to go find work, which gives you a sense of like how much work they're doing at home to take care of the kids if they were staying home instead of finding a job. And instead, $1 billion was appropriated. So it was off by $11 billion in terms of the necessary funding versus the actual funding that was allocated, just to give you kind of a sense from like the middle of the program's existence of how that sort of went. And this goes back to, again, the feminist critiques versus the feminists who were in favor of welfare reform. As you said, there were feminists who were like, we got to get these women out of the house and into the workforce. And that's the true liberation. But like a lot of the stuff openly hinged on making these just blisteringly racist attacks about, you know, African-American welfare queens. It's just one of the most offensive concepts and phrases. But it was something that was thrown around very openly. Like people were not afraid to say that in the political circles. And this is something that Barbara Ehrenreich has talked a lot about. She was one of the sort of very vocal feminist opponents of the welfare reform in the 1990s. And she said that there were so many racist stereotypes that were being thrown around. You know, something that Rachel was highlighting before off air was about Tommy Thompson talking about pregnant girls from Milwaukee pursuing the American dream, which is basically very heavily coded language there. Well, not that heavily even, but, you know, talking about a city that was, you know, around 25-30% black at that point. And, you know, if you're talking about teen pregnant moms or whatever, like, we know who he was talking about with that. It was not that well veiled. And again, it's baffling if you even stop to deconstruct the stereotypes, because the assumption there is that a single mom who's taking care of her kids and being a homemaker or whatever by herself, that she's literally just sitting there on the couch all day or something, which is mystifying. Anybody who knows what that work is like, you know, you got a mom on the go all day long, taking care of kids, cleaning stuff up, doing the dishes, preparing food. All these different things that they're doing all day around the house, and that's not being valued at all. The sort of explicitly stated assumption of the welfare reform push in the 1990s was you have to go work because we can't just give you money to sit around, as opposed to thinking of it as we are giving you money to raise your kids on your own at home, like, which takes a lot of work and energy and everything. The politicians, the political class were not willing to defend it on those terms. Even people who opposed the welfare reform, I think a lot of them weren't really willing to go to that extent and say, this program is paying people to do a certain kind of work at home. And instead it was like, no, you got to go find the work, etc. They talked a lot about culture of poverty. There was also various feminist critiques opposing this, saying like, hey, you're not really taking into account the lack of living wage jobs or the possibility of paying people enough so that a welfare, like ideally a welfare system would probably be, you know, if you are indeed trying to focus on a labor role and getting people out of poverty and that sort of thing, even setting aside the issue of like compensating women's work at home, if you're designing a program to actually be helpful in terms of getting people out of the quote unquote culture of poverty, which isn't a thing, the program you would design would be welfare would be this backstop, and then you could go out and earn more money, hopefully at a living wage job, hopefully a living wage part-time job. And your welfare check would basically pay for all the fundamentals and be this sort of baseline Rawlsian veil of ignorance setup where it's like, what do I need to be able to survive comfortably? And then the extra money that you earned, you could be putting that into a savings account. You could be setting that aside to help your kids with educational costs or whatever. Like whatever you needed to do, that extra money from a part-time job would be helping you get out of the hole or whatever. But the other thing that you need there is a functioning safety net to make sure you don't fall below that. And they just didn't really seem to understand that. And instead of providing more money or adding more flexibility for labor stuff, it was the opposite. It was like, it has to be more rigid and we're going to kick you off if you don't find a job. I mean, I would say they weren't thinking it through, but I think a lot of this was just very malicious by design and very racially motivated. Absolutely.
Yeah. And those service sector jobs like retail or hospitality or like home healthcare don't pay well or include health insurance. So you're taking away not only the TAMF benefits, you're also taking away that Medicaid benefits because those low paying part-time jobs just don't have benefits included. So you're absolutely right. We're totally cutting off any source of aid they received, and just the offset is not sufficient to make up for what we're taking away from them.
Now, let's jump back to the present day and talk about the Trump administration. While we're on the subject of TAMF, again, as I said, there were some sort of workfare requirement re-emphasis under the Trump administration in 2017 that was mostly symbolic, maybe a lot less symbolic, although part of the, you know, Trump budget in 2017 that is, I guess, inherently symbolic on some level and is never going to get passed, kind of underscored some of the problem with this, which is that annually back in 96 or whatever, when they passed welfare reform, they were like, okay, the annual budget for the welfare assistance block grants in total is going to be $16.5 billion. And this is mind-boggling to me. They never updated that number in nominal terms, let alone real terms accounting for inflation or anything or whatever, you know, or various changes in cost of living or anything like that. In nominal terms, they didn't increase the amount of money appropriated. It has remained constant. There has not even been an inflation adjustment built in or anything like that. They never updated the TANF budgeting, and the first time that there was an update proposed to it was the Trump budget proposing to cut it by 10%, cutting billions of dollars from the welfare assistance funding. That's crazy. That brings us back up to the present day, though. Let's talk about Medicaid. So again, Medicaid is basically, for the most part, a health insurance system paid for by the government, usually contracted out to various companies and administered at the state levels. As I said, the Trump administration, Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, CMS, issued guidelines of like, hey, states, you can now design waivers to start imposing work requirements onto your Medicaid programs at the state level. What do you have for us? So, Rachel, talk to me a little bit about these Medicaid work rules and who they might or might not apply to as designed by and defined by the states.
So they will require all able-bodied, quote-unquote, people who are not taking care of a disabled relative or they do not have any dependents. So people with children are supposedly exempt. Pregnant women will be exempt as well. But every able-bodied person will be required to work. And I think Kentucky, one of the largest examples that we've seen, or most prominent example that we've seen, I think they would require 80 hours a month of work. And they're going to be allowed to kind of experiment for 5 years. And I guess we'll see the effects of that. But I just wanted to emphasize the able-bodied thing, because I think we've seen agencies that define disability don't always do it very well. So people who do have disabilities that often keep them out of the workforce are labeled as fit to work. We've seen that a lot in Britain for their disability programs. So I think it will really harm disabled people who are quote unquote fit for work, but really can't perform job duties. I think in the Kentucky example, 95,000 people will be taken off the Medicaid rolls over the next 5 years. The governor doesn't seem to care what happens to them, just the fact that they aren't on Medicaid anymore. So they probably won't be able to find an alternative health insurance program. They'll really just be left alone and without any assistance for health insurance.
Which, you know, we've talked a lot about the donut hole problem with the Affordable Care Act reforms and the cancellation of the Medicaid expansion or making it opt-in, rather. But yeah, now we're at a situation where previously we had like, okay, the people who are the seniors are taken care of, the people who are low income are taken care of, like really, really low income. And then there's this gap, and then subsidies kick in, et cetera, and we got to deal with that. Now we're at a thing where they're actively trying to erode even that sort of bottom rung, the people who are really not doing very well. And again, a lot of this is going to be left up to the states to determine. Depending on how awful they're being, like, they could potentially include some seniors if they define them as being sufficiently able-bodied instead of letting these people retire in peace. You know, the other problem is they get to define what counts as qualifying work. There's been a lot of criticism, especially based on the experience with the welfare reform, of saying, hey, some of this stuff is basically like community service work that you would give someone to avoid sending them to prison, or, you know, give some rowdy teens some community service work. I guess that has maybe some value in certain contexts, but doesn't really have a value in the context of like a work requirement where you're trying to get people into the labor force, because for the purposes of skill building and resume building, doesn't really help to be on community service. Like, that's not anything particularly for building your career. So what's the point of this? The CMS chief, Seema Verma, under the Trump administration, she is actually from Kentucky. She worked in the Bevin administration that was the one really pushing this, demanding that they be allowed to create a work requirement for Medicaid. They have sort of they're first out of the gate with this in large part because of her. And she has all these quotes that she's always saying, apparently very sincerely, about like that states should seek, quote, innovations that build on the human dignity that comes with training, employment, and independence, end quote. Hard to see how that really applies to community service work. Talking about, we see people moving off of Medicaid as a good outcome, which, as Rachel said, and then on to what? Like, if they don't get a job that has health insurance benefits or something, they're kind of out of luck. And a lot of these jobs, as you said, don't come with benefits.
Yeah, and that's explicitly against the whole reason for Medicaid expansion in the first place. So we have these opposing forces. It can't be a good outcome to kick people off of the Medicaid program without any alternative in place. And another thing I wanted to highlight was felons have an extremely hard time finding jobs. So putting a work requirement on felons when a lot of places haven't banned the box, so they are allowed to ask about your criminal history during the job application process. A lot of those people won't be able to find a job, and therefore they won't be able to complete this requirement. Taking out the social safety net out from under felons, people who have served their sentence, who have paid their debt to society, just really disincentivizes rejoining that society and becoming a productive member of that society and finding a community. So it just really leaves them out in the cold, and then there's no incentive to not reoffend.
Now, if you go to arsenalfordemocracy.com, we'll have for the episode page for this episode 211, we will have all the links and references we've talked about, as well as some more that we aren't going to have time to get to because there's a lot to go over. The article that I definitely recommend is a very, very detailed article from the Salt Lake City Tribune in January of 2018. They just have a ton of data and information about what the guidelines were that were being issued by the Trump administration. They also remind us that Medicaid enrolls 68 million low-income Americans, including children, pregnant women, people with disabilities, and the elderly. Yeah, some of these aren't going to be under the work requirements, but again, a lot of it depends on how the states define certain categories. The Salt Lake City Tribune did an article on this because 10 states are saying they want to impose work requirements on Medicaid, including Utah. They want to add a work requirement to their Medicaid expansion that they did recently, which was aimed at homeless people, generally homeless people without kids. These are some of the like poorest of the poor in extreme poverty. And they're like, hey, gang, we're going to give you Medicaid, but you also have to have a work requirement, which is sort of interesting because that kind of goes against the spirit of some of the other reforms that Utah had been pursuing. They had been experimenting around with giving housing to people who were homeless. But at a certain point, I guess they went back to this like sort of work requirement model that is a problem for a lot of reasons, as we've talked about. Obviously, there's also a lot of stuff about the Kentucky proposals. You can check out some links on that. You mentioned about the people with convictions. There's also a lot of people who are struggling with opioid addiction, especially in many of these states under consideration. In some cases, the states may say, okay, if you have an addiction thing, then you're exempt from this work requirement. But some states may not and probably won't allow those exemptions. And so what we can expect to see is demanding that people who are just on the beginning of the road to recovery suddenly having to go find work and really struggling with that because it can be hard to get a job or hold a job when you are dealing with addiction, especially at the beginning of that recovery process. These reforms are being vehemently opposed by the National Medical Association, which is an organization for African-American health professionals. And again, there are a lot more links available at arsenalfordemocracy.com on this. We included a bunch of different articles from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities on work requirements don't work, talking about a lot of the problems with the welfare reform work requirements. There was a whole Atlantic article in March 2017 specifically on the problem with Medicaid work requirements. That's a good one to read. And there's various other articles as well. You know, there's so much we could talk about, but the bottom line here is that you've created a program where instead of it being a backstop of like, hey, we're going to guarantee that no matter what, you have access to health insurance. Now they're saying, nope, you're not necessarily going to have that. That's one new anxiety you have to be worried about is your health. Even when you're at the bottom of society and everything's already against you and going very poorly, we're going to take away that one last safety net and just demand that you find work, whether or not there is any, whether or not that work comes with any benefits health insurance wise. This is just going to be a total disaster for so many people. This is going to destroy lives. And as always, sometimes you get Democrats being like, well, we should, you know, make sure that the deserving people get the benefits or whatever. And it's like, no, just build universal programs, let people have them because most people are going to need them, or a lot of people are going to need them. Don't worry so much about whether or not some people are getting them that maybe shouldn't, because probably who cares? Something like healthcare is a universal right anyway, so what are you talking about? Just make sure that everyone has access to this. So this is like one of the few areas that's going relatively well in the healthcare system and has this government input, and now we're going to make it worse. That's what we're looking at right now. As usual, whether it's work requirements, requirements or drug testing for benefits or any of these things or adding paperwork. All of this is meant to add anxieties and administrative hurdles and paperwork mountains and everything to keep people from actually taking advantage of these benefits that they have a right to, so that they will eventually quit the program or, failing that, be forced off of it because of some work requirement. That is where we are on this. It's very dire, but we wanted to talk about the history of the work requirements program and this current proposal that is coming down the pipeline very quickly. Rachel, thank you so much for joining me this week to talk about this.
It's always a pleasure, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on arsenalfordemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.